I'd like to thank the organizers, who are also my collaborators, for asking me to give this talk. And so I'm going to talk about things I've been working with people in Montreal, and that is mainly John Topp, Dino Jacobson, and Alain Bourgier. So they are actually the main people who work on these things. So if you have difficult questions, you can ask them. They're all here, right? Yeah, all three of them are here. So it's about spin chains. But before I do spin chains, since my background is in differential geometry, so I'll maybe start with some simple geometric things that I am interested in, what led me to these Gordon spin chains. So it will be about Gordon spin chains and some asymptotic problems. Well, maybe I should call them spin models, actually, because spin chain is a very technical word. So I'll start with the round sphere, as we have been listening to Harold Donnelly's talk. So I start with SN. And actually, we were talking about asymptotics when, well, the Laplacian has eigenvalues. These are the eigenvalues. And of course, we were talking about what happens when lambda this goes to infinity, sort of high-energy asymptotics. But there's another thing that is interesting, is low-energy asymptotics when the dimension goes to infinity. So that's something maybe I'd like to explain on the sphere first. So don't worry about the high end. Let's look at lambda 1, well, the positive, first one. And the eigenfunctions are, as we heard from Donnelly's talk, actually n plus 1 of them, right? The linear functions on Euclidean space restricted to the sphere are the first eigenfunctions of the sphere. And so what happens when n is big? They concentrate too, in a way which is different from concentration in high-energy asymptotics. So let's look at x0. That's the height. So plus 1 here, 0 here, minus 1 here. That's x0. In which sense do they concentrate? If I look at the volume of the spots where x0 is, let's say, greater than epsilon, right, and divide by the volume of the sphere, so how big is it? So that's the strip, right, height epsilon. And that volume is actually very close to 1. Oh, sorry, it's a complement of that. So it's actually very small. It's exponentially small, maybe some other constant, epsilon squared, times the dimension. So that's another way that things can concentrate. It's measure concentration. So this is the large M. So that's what the title of my talk, thermodynamic, actually means. Of course, there are many ways that people use the word thermodynamic limit. But we're interested in problems where the dimension of the phase space, or the dimension we're looking at, is going to infinity. Well, we're also interested in K going to infinity. So I would use K for the semi-classical limit, and N is going to be always the dimension, so the thermodynamic parameter. So it gives you the picture of what I want to look at. So this is an easy estimate. Maybe I should even tell you how to estimate it. Well, there are two geometric ways, right? One is just, this is the volume of the sphere. So as we know, there's a sine function that shows up for spheres, as in Donnelly's talk. So it's just sine to the power n minus 1, my dt. It goes from, you know, if you go from, see, that's pi by 2. That's the equator, right? So 0 to pi. And that piece. Right, because when n goes to infinity, it's very sharply peaked near the equator. Right, in that sense, it's also a concentration phenomenon. So that's the kind of thing that we were looking for in more general problems, things called Gordon spin chains. But even the Gordon spin chains, I want to motivate by doing harmonic, equation or the Laplacian on the sphere, so Fn with the round metric, right? So that's the other direction, maybe. So we know from the talks that the multiplicity is pretty large. I was listening to the talk, so I should remember now. Minus 1, no, over k, minus n plus. So 2 less, because you can always multiply by the r square, right? X square I, x, the sum of the x I square. So it's always, you subtract of this 2 from the top space. Homogeneous polynomials, this is kind of explained. So that's the dimension, it's pretty large. And we explained this morning that if you have pretty large multiplicities, you can also have other types of concentration phenomena. But in quantum integral, the thing is, we want to split. So if you have a large eigenspace, it's nice to split it up. And the way to split up a big eigenspace is to find commuting operators. So there are, and I'll show you what the commuting operators are. So just write it down, and then that will motivate my spin chain. So let's look at these operators. I'll write them down first. So you pick some numbers, positive numbers. They have to do with elliptic coordinates. Distinct numbers, n of them if n is a dimension. And look at this. I'll tell you what this is. So where xij is a rotation vector. So it's sort of a canonical quantization. Maybe I should write it. Of the action. So that's the rotation vector field, which rotates the I direction to the J direction. Well, maybe this way wrong. Right? That induces a vector field on the sphere. It's invariantly defined. And if you square it, if you add up all the squares, it's actually the Laplacian up to a constant. But if you weight them like that, and that comes from elliptic coordinate systems, they all commute. And they commute with a Laplacian, too, because the Laplacian is a sum, as I said. So in a way, it's interesting to understand this large eigenspace by splitting it up into common eigenfunctions of these commuting operators. So that's a nice, you know, split into nicer eigenfunctions. This is a, you know, zero. But the standard basis for Rn. Yeah. A. Well, maybe I should write. Yeah, this is well defined, right? This is on the sphere with coordinates. Right? So this is a vector field, and you restrict it to the sphere. It's a rotational vector field. So if you rotate the ith and jth direction, so you have a sphere. You take two, let's say 1 and 3, right, and you rotate. And that induces a circle from the sphere, and that vector field, that's the thing on the zero. Oh, sorry. Ah, excuse me, that's wrong. That's the other way around. Sorry, I didn't see the mistake. Is that what you're asking? So you have a round sphere, and you rotate. It's invariantly defined vector field, and you square them up. So anyway, so that is maybe at first sight not obvious, but if you compute it, of course, you can find that we commute. But the Gordon spin chains and more general commuting quantum integrable systems are discovered by more an algebraic technique, which I like to explain. But before I do that, maybe I should actually tell you a little bit how that relates to elliptic coordinates, because it looks like from the blue sky, right, how you get that operator. So actually, it goes back, it's historically quite interesting. So you use elliptic coordinates in Rn. So that's separate. So that is used, of course, not just for the sphere, it's used for, well, ellipsoids, basically, right? People want to understand the ellipsoid as an integrable system. And Jacobi, you know, it's no subject that people started doing this. And elliptic coordinates, I like to write it down. So if you have a point, you solve this equation. maybe 0.2. And we solve for u, given x. Let's say it was here. Right? You solve for u, and that gives you the elliptic coordinates of the point on the sphere. So that gives you x goes to u. Right? And actually, you can recover x by x squared by doing the following thing. X squared is given by, I write it down, and then I'll tell you what it is. That's not a good notation. Did I use? So where P is the polynomial of, well, I get the elliptic coordinates, and I can think of the points as defining a polynomial whose roots are those elliptic coordinates, and the A is just this polynomial where you choose those points, and then AI is just when I divide it by AI U is A. Just take off the ith factor. So that's the way elliptic coordinates and spherical coordinates are related. So they're related by polynomials and certain rational expressions. And of course, you have to take square root. So it's only defined in a positive quadrant. And then this defines the hyperelliptic curve, if you like. Right, that defines the elliptic coordinate. So that's very classical. And if you write the metric in terms of this elliptic coordinate, they form in the polynomial coordinate system. So it's not conformal, but the lines are all, so they're 90 degrees, right? So they form in a polynomial coordinate system on the sphere. It's not the usual radial and angular coordinates, because if you have a 20 million dimensional sphere, radius and angular means you have one and you have only two, right? You actually want to split it really into 20 million. So you want the nodal line to look like that of the functions that you're looking. So they have to, sort of the zonal harmonics that people normally use, f of r and the zero sets are actually very thick. So it doesn't really split the harmonic polynomial. So that's one reason it's used there. But anyway, the metric is actually quite interesting. Well, that's a constant. It's, in terms of those elliptic coordinates, it's this. Well, I write it like this. And then you multiply. Maybe I should write it, sorry. I should be a little bit more careful. Then I don't put the square. I take all the, so in terms of the metric, I write it down in terms of coordinates. That's a coefficient. So it's not a conformal parametrization, but it's orthogonal, because it's each coefficient, there's no mixed terms, right? That's when a metric is orthogonal. And then here you get this, where you go from 0 to n, to a, sorry. So that's the metric. It's very close to these things. So in that metric, well, because the metric is like that, the volume form also has a nice formula. But the main thing is that if you use these coordinates, you can find, you can solve, you can, well, that's the, it's called the middle answer. You can try to solve for, let's see, well, my Laplacian is maybe. My Laplacian is
summation over I.
Yeah, that's right. Summation over I. So they're in terms of these coordinates, and these are the factors. The one is when it's very closely related to the P's and the A's, right? You compute those things and you find those factors. And the way to solve this equation that Niven tried was not the way with the radial and angular coordinates, but to try to write this wave function, this eigenfunction, as a product of polynomials in the elliptic coordinates and see what you have to solve. So that was the way Niven tried it. So you put in psi equal to, let's say you write these, you choose your elliptic coordinates, then you write a polynomial with some roots. Right, maybe I have to get my notation. Yeah. P theta. theta k minus, yeah, okay. Let me write it down carefully. So it's a product over all the ui's, and each ui, I write a polynomial of degree k, right? So that's a polynomial of degree k with those roots. And I take a product, and this is only dependent on ui, so you're separating, really separating variables. This is a polynomial which is a product of polynomials of one variable each. That's a key thing. So if you try that, you plug that in and compute the Laplacian, which is a little bit more complicated than in the lectures yesterday, right? So you have to do a little bit of work with that expression. If you compute it, you find that this is an eigenfunction. So if and only if, well, lambda would of course depend on the degree, but the point is how do you choose these parameters so that they satisfy Laplace's equation? So that's where this magic equation shows up. So the equation is the following. So if and only if. So you quarter. So that's my normalization. For each k, you sum from. That's this rational thing. And then you do this. So that's the condition that Niven found. So if you choose, given your coordinate system, the a's are fixed, right? That describes the coordinate system. And if you choose the polynomials p, so the roots of the polynomial to satisfy this equation and make the product, then you have a harmonic polynomial. That is harmonic, you know, eigenvector of all these commuting integrals. So that's more than just finding because you split the coordinates. So that's Niven discovered that, but it's known as the Bethe-Ansatz. So that's my motivation of what is called the Bethe-Ansatz equations that's used in spin chain models. So basically our work, you know, involved in understanding the nature of these equations with different limits. So that's what I'm going to talk about. So that's the motivation of why we want to study equations like that. So it looks like, you know, it's sort of a rational expression. There's not much to see. So given the a's, you want to solve for thetas. For example, if a's are positive, how do the thetas look like? Right? And the solution is also simple. So then this function qu, which is this u, so now forget about the I, so there are n of them, just for each function separately, so I do this, well, according to degree k. So I look at this polynomial, and it satisfies a second order ODE, a simple second order ODE, which is called the Lamé equation. So this implies, so it's very classical, and this is the equation. Well, according to my notation, I think it's AIU. No, I shouldn't write it like that. This guy. Oh. I'm sorry, I shouldn't write it like that. It's after the bottom line. I should write still 2BU. Q prime plus du q equal to 0. So where a, b, c are polynomials in u? So degree n plus 1, degree n minus 1. So normally, the equations ODEs don't have polynomial solutions, but you know, I have a polynomial solution with polynomial coefficients, and that's pretty rare. That's why people study these special equations in those days. But it came from, one of the reasons it came from was to separate variables on a sphere. And it's not the usual separation of variables. It leads to this quantum integral system. So that's an equation, and of course people study it slightly more, well, I should say, B over A. If I divide it by A, I get this. that one fourth is there, right? And you, and also, if you like, you could also write it in terms of this function, you know, phi, which, if you're interested in the zeros, you would look at the logarithmic determinant. And then that satisfies the Riccati equation. Let's see, phi. I think it's right. You divide by Q and do the change of variables. And that also plays a role. So in the simplest case, maybe it looks so complicated, so maybe I should give you the simplest case in two dimensions. The example of such an equation is right, everybody has seen this equation from hydrogen atom or quantum mechanics or whatever you learn on S2. So that's an example of an equation, right? The simplest case where you have two zeros that has plus and minus one, and so 2 points, and you look at, you're on F2, right? So that's the simplest equation. So, but even in that simplest equation, if you look at the zeros of Q, you can notice that if you do this, you change it to the Riccati form, and you look at your scale over K. But if you scale over K, then you can take the other limit that I don't want to take today. You can take the K infinity limit. And then this term would drop out. And all your, and this term would drop out after dividing by, because the leading term is, there's a square, right? K square. You do that, then you get that this phi infinity it satisfies phi infinity square plus c equal to 0. Right. Well, maybe I should have written minus c. So that, of course, also gives you, in this case, when this is k, my k is L square, the law that the zeros of this Jacobi polynomials are distributed like, that's the distribution you get. That's the phi tilde in this case, right? That's the equation that satisfies. And that isn't well known. That's the Oxheim law for the zeros of, asymptotic zeros of Jacobi polynomial in the large K limit. Okay. So you can, of course, push that. And actually, this has been done more precisely in a nice paper by Finkelstein. I better write it down correctly. Martinez Finkelstein. But that's a double name, right? Plus stuff. And so they've done this K asymptotic, so generalizing this fact, of course, and also with the B, then you have to do some quantum integration on Riemann surface to get the limiting measure for the zeros. So the limiting measure for the zeros you can get by looking at this limiting nature of this algebraic function. By some obvious transform. So that's one result in that direction where you don't take the large M limit, but you take the large K limit. So, and actually, I should say, before I move on to the Gaudin-Schmidt chain, you can look at this equation in a different point of view, right? So let's forget they come from real numbers. Just look at this as a complex equation. So these are complex numbers, and you're trying to find, say, complex theta that satisfies this equation. And that could be thought of as the following problem. So let's complexify the situation because that will also lead to the Gaudin spin chain. So that means that you have points A1, A2, and so on in C, which you can think of as on a Riemann sphere. And now these are fixed, and you give them some charges, let's say a quarter, right? Electric charges. And now you're trying to find points, these are the thetas, theta j maybe, right? such that they're in electrostatic equilibrium under the law of potential. So the potential is, whose derivative is this? It's of course the logarithm. So in the two planes, the potential is the logarithm, right? So the potential is between two points is this. That's the potential. And what you're trying to do is fix those points first, the A's, and you throw in K theta and see where they line up, right? What's the equilibrium position? So that is solved by this equation. You differentiate it. And actually, it's not an easy problem. So Dima and some of his students are actually looking at that in the complex plane, even for 3 points. So there's some computer pictures, maybe. I don't know. I can't show them. But to understand the nature of the solution of this problem in the complex plane is a bit, you know, it's not too much is known, yeah? Yeah. Oh. So they charge, let's say, the same. It depends a little bit on when you start to put negative weights here, it's more complicated. But let's stick to positive charges. So they. And of course, if you do it on the line, but if you restrict to the line, there's a very beautiful theorem. That's another classical theorem, which we have used in analyzing this problem. This is the Heiner-Schielsche's theorem, so maybe I should state it quickly here. So, now you're on a line. Let's scale it so that, you know, they lie between 0 and 1, so alpha 0, alpha n. So this is scale invariant. So there are these intervals. And now I want to fit in the theta. Let's put more generally, let's put some positive weights in there. It could be quarter, but it could be something else. Now, the Heiner-Schielsche theorem says that if you have charges there, at these points, fixed charges, and you put in these, your little thetas, right, k of them, so that this equation holds, so that they're in electrostatic equilibrium, and that is exactly for each partition of k, so there are n intervals. So you split them up, right? So that in the first interval there are k one of them, k two of them, and so you add up to get k. So for each choice of that partition, there exists a unique solution. Well, theta one, that's the theta k of the beta ansatz equation. So in particular, a unique solution of that. This equation, the Lamé equation, right? So you can count the number of solutions. It's given by the number of ways you can split k into these pieces. So that's the combinatorics of harmonic polynomials, if you like. You can add them up and see how many you get and so on. But that's a very old theorem, I don't know. Kind of proof that it's at most, I guess, right? And then Stieltjes proves it's complete. So that's... But if you use that theorem, we can actually get some easy results about so the preliminary results we had with all four of us were simple things. It's just the distribution, density of these zeros, right, theta. So that's what you could measure, right? How do they fill up the interval if I let the alphas go to infinity in the large dimensional limit? And the simplest result is, of course, we actually, well, let's suppose we choose, yeah. So I should say the density of zeros. So you take the delta function at the theta case, and you sum over all possible ways to add up this k, right? So you get all the possible combinations for a fixed k, for a fixed energy, if you like, and all these configurations. And if you add them up, that measure goes to, well, and then I have to say, well, this minus the measure on the alpha, on the A's. Did I write down alpha? Yeah, I write down alpha. Oh, one of it, yeah. So measure. So I, you know, integrals, people do this, right? So it's the measure, the total measure is 1. Okay, so I divide by the number of elements. So that is, goes to 0 like 1 over n. So that's the first result. And we also have a result where we look a little bit more carefully at the variance. And maybe I should state it slightly like this. I should write it correctly too. So now you sum over each configuration. So these are all possible, right? Now you sum for a fixed ki. So you now look at this. These roots for a fixed splitting. And now you, let's see, you square it. I better be careful with the, I can take the test function, but let me write it down. Okay, take a test function. It's a little easier to write it down. So if I take a test function and evaluate at these thetas and square it, and then, and then take the average, and then take it at alpha for each thing, and then you square it, so you're talking about the variance. This. Squared. And then you average over all configurations, so all these combinations. That goes to 0, like O of 1 over n plus O of 1 over 2. So that's the variance result. No, it's a slightly more elaborate than just the variance of everything. You just take the variance of each finite partition, so a sequence of eigenvalues, if you like, and then average over all things with a given degree. That goes to 0 like that. Yeah. Well, this is true for, that's a good point. So this is true for a generic choice of alpha I. So almost, this one is true for any alpha I. This is, these two results are actually true for any alpha I, sorry. So later we have results where we have to take the measure. So this is, you can fix any number of alpha I's, and then you can increase the number of alpha I's, right? Because I use the measure here. Right? The alpha I's introduce that measure. Positive. Yeah. Positive. Well, because it uses the Heimer field check as well, basically. Okay? So that's the four of us. So now I should describe a little bit what a Gordon spin chain is. So up to now I've avoided. So what is a Gordon spin chain? So that's the following thing. So you take S L. Spin model. So it's a quantum integrable system on a Hilbert space. So it's a set of operators that commute on a Hilbert space. It doesn't have to be L2 of spheres or anything. It's just some abstract Hilbert space. And the Hilbert space is a tensor product of some, maybe I should write down rows. Maybe I stick back to where you should think of it like that. So I pick sites on the Riemann sphere. These are sites. And then I have two things. Well, the sites are given by the, go back to the A's. And each site, I pick a representation, so a vector space, which I call rho I, where rho is a weight, highest weight. Representation of SL2. So the Lie algebra, right. So you can think of that each site being occupied by a C2 vector space. The simplest representation would be C2, right, SL2. And that's a spin model. So the normal spin is plus, minus 1. But if you quantize it, it lives in vector space spanned by the plus and minus 1, which is C2. But you can also go higher spin. Depends on the spin model. So that's a vector space. And how do you make those operators So the way people do, you know, instead of going back to that old-fashioned stuff, the way people do it algebraically nowadays is to write down the L, the lax operator. Lax operator. We use a spectral parameter. So it's a 2x2 SL2 matrix. So it has SU minus SU, S minus U. Or maybe I should write S3, because that's a notation of physicists. That's the Z direction. It is spin. So that's a Pauli matrices, 1, 0, 0, and so on, right? 1 minus 1, 0, 1. So up, spin up. You know, that's the creation operator that kills it, and that creates something out of 0. So that's, and then I have to write down what these S pluses are. So I write it down. So S, well, in this model, there are many ways to do these things, but one way to do is the rational model is you take, maybe I should, in that representation, okay. So I put a star to denote one of those guys, right? So I could have written the whole matrix too. I should have done that. So each object is a little matrix that acts on the vector space Vi that I chose, and only there. And the rest is identity. So that's the notation I use with the sub I. Means that this representation is acting on this vector space Vi at that site. And then you write this rational expression so that it's a residue at that point. So it's called a rational, rational lax operator. And then, so that relates to these things, right? It's slightly different, but it's, so the point is that this LU has the following property, that if you take the L square of U, that's called the transfer matrix. Well, it basically comes from the following fact that people actually use this, right? People look at the characteristic polynomial of LU, and the coefficients are invariants. That's the way people make invariant Hamiltonian of the lax operator. So in this case, of course, the trace is zero, so the next one is this. It's a quadratic Hamiltonian. So this is an operator on, depending on the parameter U, acting on that big Hilbert space. Right? It acts on each side like that and so on. And then the main fact is that these operators all commute. So these TUs, so that comes out of the choice of this function. So I should mention that they are much more general systems. So this function looks very simple because we're working on the Riemann sphere. So it's just a simple thing with a pole, rational function. But if you were working on a Riemann surface, the elliptic surface, you would use appropriate functions, theta functions and things like that, which has the correct pole order. That's what you need. So you could actually do these things on a Riemann surface. But let's stick to the rational sphere case. And that's the lax formalism of, well, that's called a Gordon spin chain. Okay, so this set of operators is commuting, and so then you can do partial fractions, if you like, or residue of these things, and you get this. They have poles at the alphas, and then these are operators, and then you get, well, basically Casimir, so I think the second order terms are just the squares, the Casimir, which, as I said, it's a scalar. So that's why they commute, because they commute for all U, and these are already commutative, so these are scalars, so these operators commute. And that's the way people find commuting operators. That's one way to do it. But that's used quite a lot in physics. So you could change this model a bit using different functions and maybe using a different group. But then basically, once you have a lax operator, which satisfies certain algebraic properties, you can find these commuting integrals. Although, of course, it's very algebraic, so sometimes I think that physicists are a lot more algebraic than mathematicians. They actually write down the observables as an algebra. They don't really. Yeah, that's Hi is the residue of this object, this function at that point. Yeah, it will be an operator on the Hilbert, on that big space. Well, trace in that 2x2 sense, but each element is an operator on the big Hilbert space. Right? It's a 2x2 matrix of operators. It's a quantum integral system, right? So you can write sort of nonlinear Schrodinger equation and stuff like that in that format too. People do that. Although, you know, when you, as I said, it's only algebraic, so when you want to solve it, you still have to do something else. But basically, that's the algebraic formalism for finding commuting operators. You can kind of, you know, modify it and soup it up, but that's the simplest example. And that's a... So that's, you know, this example is the Gordon model. So as I said, there are other models. If you look in physics literature, the important models are Calogero-Sutherland, and that's on an elliptic curve, and there are, you know, similar models on other things. So they play a, I should say they not only play a role in this sense, but physicists believe that some of these spin models actually you can use to calculate correlation functions for string theory, for example. So they do actually use it seriously. So in that sense, it's not just separating variables on the sphere, but maybe they're all related. String might be just some harmonic polynomial on the sphere. But anyway, so that's a Gordon spin chain model. And now I should finish. Let's see. I should say what I'm going to do now. So what we've been doing recently has been to look at the potential. Well, so which for the beta hundred, right? So these are the critical points of a potential, and the potential, if you take the log of it at least, it's given by, you know, it's given by this. Right? Maybe I should. So you have these little particles running around with this potential, and then you have, well, for scaling purposes, I put on. Well, maybe I should put down yet. And then you have some fixed sites, this alpha. Maybe. Okay. Log. Right, where that's on the line. And then that's the potential that you're looking at. And now in the large end limit, so you want to understand, let's call it W. Well, it depends on a number of things, right? W depends on X and N and K and so on. So that's a potential function. And in thermodynamic limit, when N goes to infinity, people are interested in studying this. Well, maybe I should write on. That's the temperature and Boltzmann constant and this. Right? What is this? When N goes to large, and you integrate over all the dx. And that's a partition function, which depends on all these parameters we put in. I agree, I'm not writing down the alphas in there anymore, right? But depends certainly on the number k and other things of choice, not your choice. So of course, what we're trying to do now is to understand the limit when n goes to infinity of this function, the behavior of this function. And maybe I should just write down one result. So things like that, maybe to relate to this, I should mention that things like that are studied in random matrix theory, where the potential is actually simpler. As somebody pointed out, with the why do the don't the points go away? If you study on the line, this potential, and then the log thing, so which I can write like this. Let's say square. So if you integrate that. That's the potential that people study in random matrix theory, and you can think of it as a harmonic potential on the line, so things are being attracted toward the origin, but on the other hand, there's this repulsion between the eigenvalues. Right? It comes out of looking at the eigenvalues of the random matrix. So it's pretty close, except this term is okay, right? That's the same term, that's the random undeterminate. But this term is slightly different in our case, and we want to understand what happens the way people do in random matrix theory to these potentials when n goes to infinity. That's what we've been doing. And the result, maybe I should be quick because I don't have much time. So there are two steps. First step is the place by integrals over alpha, sort of by an integral. The expected value over alpha. And so you kind of think of alphas when there are lots of them, you think of them as forming a density, and so you replace by this integral. Maybe I should even write d alpha. Let's say the scale is from 0 to 1. So let's call it v of x. That's the key function that we use, which is when we replace this term, instead of having these alphas floating around, we average it out. Of course, you have to do some estimates to know that it's correct, right? But basically, up to the order of square root of n, you can replace by an integral, because that's the law of large numbers. So you do that, so then we have to study that function, and it turns out that this function looks like this. Well, it's actually, I can write down the function. So that's a function. You can integrate it off. And then, of course, it depends on the sign. So if I draw it the wrong way around, it actually looks like, I don't know. I should draw it like this again. So there's a minimum. Yeah, it depends. I mean, maybe I should put a negative sign there. So that is 1 plus log 2. And it occurs at half. And then it becomes, it has a limit at 1 and 0, but it goes, it's very steep there. So we're doing asymptotics, according to our sign, we have to do asymptotics in these regimes. So where we have to understand the nature of the function, do steepest descent, asymptotics of this when n goes to infinity in that regime. And the main key step is just the fact that actually, maybe I should end with some formula. So I gave my second year students this problem, but some of them solved it actually. So these integrals can be computed. That's due to Jacobi and Euler, I think. So if you look at it carefully, it turns out that it's not as bad as you think. So this term might bother you when you try to integrate it out, but actually it is finite. And so basically you end up by, analyzing this behavior, that actually this function, at least the logarithm of that, converts after the right scaling, roughly nk, to a distribution. Well, maybe I should write it like this. There's some such term, which is which looks like a random matrix distribution, except it's not a square. It's a Laguerre polynomial, they call it. These are radio Hermite polynomials. So that's the result we get in the large n limit for, there's some scaling factors you have to look at. But that comes from analyzing the behavior near these points. But if you sort of want to get the random matrix model, you could also do that, but then you have to put the weights to be negative, which is physically a little bit unreasonable. From the problems we're looking at, the weights are normally always positive, right? Whether you do representations. If you do negative weights, it turns out that you analyze this function near this point, which is easy, because it has a non-degenerate minimum there. And then, it looks like a quadratic form, right? And then you get this. So that's maybe mathematically interesting, but from the point of view of the model, it's not the interesting case. So maybe I should stop here. Thanks a lot. Thank you.